This is the Happiness Quotient. Today on the Happiness Quotient, America's only full-time professor of art crime, Erin Thompson. She studies a variety of relations between art and crime, including the looting of antiquities, museum theft, art made by detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and the legalities and ethics of digital reproductions of cultural heritage. Erin Thompson has discussed these topics for the New York Times, CNN, NPR, and the Freakonomics podcast, among many others. And coming up next, she'll also be on The Happiness Quotient. Erin Thompson is an author, speaker, art crime professor at the John Jay College at the City University of New York. All of my answers came, driving myself insane. I had a dragon to tame to get happy. Welcome. If you like our podcast and enjoy this episode or any episode of the HQ, please subscribe to me wherever you may be listening. Leave me a rating and a review, which are so important to a podcast's success. And if you know someone who's interested in art or art crime, be sure to personally share this episode with them. Ooh, art crime. Yes, art crime. How cool. What a great topic. We are going to go deep into it today. Would you also check out A Course in Happiness? You can find it at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient. You'll find there a free PDF download of A Course in Happiness. I'm Tom Pollard. Did you ever see the film Raiders of the Lost Ark? Duh, right? Indiana Jones is trying to find the Ark of the Covenant before the sinister Nazis get it first in their attempt to exploit it and harness its powers for evil. Well, not all art crime is really quite like that, but art crime is fascinating. Anyone who has even a passing interest in art theft knows of the 1990 Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum theft, which is still unsolved, still a mystery, and still a devastating tale of lost masterpieces of irreplaceable art. We will talk about that today in the interview. Erin Thompson is an art crime professor at the City University of New York. I first discovered Erin on Twitter. Yes, I admit I'm a Twitter guy, albeit an abject failure, endeavoring to find one or two more people who might be interested in this episode or that of my podcast. Anyway, Erin's Twitter is so, so fun. Pictures of her new hats or new books that she's reading. She is a bibliophile in the extreme. Recent art crime cases, comments about being a parent. And recently, when Erin asked her followers to help remember the name of a late 1980s punk rock band that was escaping her, I, well, knew the answer. And voila, we were officially introduced. Sans Creeper Effect. I asked her for an interview, and within a week, we had this excellent convo about what her work entails in being an art crime professor. Let me add that Erin's headline on Twitter promotes her forthcoming book, Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of America's Public Monuments, which we will talk about today. Her Twitter handle, by the way, is @artcrimeprof. And if you're on Twitter, be sure to follow. Here's my wonderful interview with Professor Erin L. Thompson, John Jay College of the City University of New York, on June 27th, 2021. Thank you for taking time out of your day. It's really exciting. Believe it or not, like, art crime gets me going. This is cool stuff, you know, and I'm not talking about just like because I watched Raiders of the Lost Ark and things like that, but it does have some, you know, some hints of things like that. It's art crime has gone on as long as there's been art, I would imagine.
That is true.
How does somebody find themselves the only full-time art crime professor in the United States? How did that, was that something that got you, the ancient history, or was it something more modern?
Well, there were a lot of steps involved, all of which make sense only in retrospect. So yeah. Seemed like a bunch of flying leaps going forward. So I was getting my PhD in art history in ancient Greek and Roman and ancient Near Eastern art history. And I was writing my dissertation on Greek painted vases, comic ones. So ones that made fun of gods and heroes, you know, showed Zeus instead of going and slaying a Titan, running away in fear or something like that. And some earlier scholars of these vases had said, oh, these can't be real. You know, they don't show the dignity and splendor of ancient Greece. So I got to thinking, well, how do we know if an antiquity is real or not? And I assumed the answer would be simple. You know, there must be a bada bing, bada boom checklist of tests. And it turns out that the answer is not so simple at all. The only way we can know for sure is if it came from a documented scientific archaeological expedition. Almost always, there have been exceptions. Yeah. And there is just a whole lot of room for error in connoisseurship or scientific testing. So then I thought, wait, well, if an antiquity isn't from an excavation, how does it get to us? Which is something that people don't often think about on purpose. You know, a museum tries to make you think that an object was used in antiquity and then boom, magically reappeared in the glass case in the museum several thousand years later. Like, what happened in between? We won't talk about that. So I got more and more interested in the questions of the illicit market for antiquities and ended up also thinking I'm never going to get a job as an art historian. So I went to law school. Yeah. And I told them, oh, well, I want to study art crime and legal issues, but I thought I'm never actually going to be able to do that. I'll just do that on the side. So I was a lawyer for a couple of years and kept on my own researching and publishing on art crime related issues. And then John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which is part of the City University of New York, posted a job for someone who had a PhD and a JD and wanted to research art crime. And I kind of looked around and thought, oh, I guess that's me, you know? So I am very, very fortunate that I get to do what I do.
That is amazing. That's a great story. I think that's probably what I find with a lot of people that I talk to, not just here on this, you know, doing interviews with a podcast, but people have an inkling of something that they love or are passionate about or interested in. And then it's always there and they go down a path of something that makes sense, right? Like, I'm going to be an attorney. I'm going to practice law and this and that. And then, but it's always there. And then boom, this opportunity arises and you jump on it. It's like you were preparing all along for this one door to open. And that's so cool. And here you are still doing it.
And then since I've gotten this job, you know, I could have focused very narrowly, but I keep expanding out the boundaries of what counts as my scholarship or field of interest. And really just because I get interested in things and want to find out more about them and find out more and find out more and find out more. And then suddenly, oh, I'm one of the people who knows the most about this thing. So there's some, you know, waiting for the door to open. And then there's also a lot of just making your own opportunities and storing up this information and knowledge until you can do something with it.
Yeah. Well, your Twitter feed is a good case in point of what you just said, because it's one of the best Twitter accounts that I follow. And you know, you can click the little, hello, look at me now, art crime professor. It's like I put with the little bell on that. I follow probably five people and yours is one of them. And when we agreed to do this interview, you said, well, try to, you know, what do you want to talk about? And at first I had a really good idea of what I wanted to talk about. Then I started scrolling down in your Twitter feed. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is actually getting harder and harder as time goes on. There's, we could go deep into so many different topics. So let me start with one of the first ones in my life that really intrigued me. Not the first time in my life, but in more recent memory, and that's, you had talked about the cradle of civilization and the destruction of art. And that to me was something that impacted me greatly, watching the gigantic statues of the Buddha being blown up in I believe it was in Syria.
That was in Afghanistan, but then Syria has also seen a lot of destruction recently.
So what's happening there? Like, why is that taking place, and why would people be threatened by a piece of art?
Well, precisely because other people love that art. So the deliberate destruction of cultural heritage has long been a technique of war. And if you think about it, it's a really good one. What, for example, the Islamic State did when taking over territory in Syria and areas of Iraq a couple of years ago is they'd drive into a new village, a new town. They'd figure out what was the most important identity, cultural space or object in that town, the shrine, the church, the museum, the mosque, if they thought it was of a heretical brand of Islam, they would take over that building, fly the Islamic State flag from on top, and then go around town with loudspeakers on trucks saying, "We're going to demolish this." And then they would do it. And if you were a resident of that town, if you were a civilian, you'd think, I am next. You know, they have just destroyed the thing that is keeping me in this town, the thing important to my identity. They will have no hesitation going after me. And that's what created these waves of refugees out of Islamic State occupied territories as people were afraid. And that's, if you're an Islamic State general, a perfect technique. You don't have to go house to house fighting people. You can just use what people love to frighten them and get them out of your way. And what appeared in the Western media was more the destruction of things that people in the West are more interested in, ancient Roman ruins from Roman Syria, things mentioned in the Bible, some ancient Assyrian things. But really the bulk of the destruction carried out by the Islamic State were more modern Islamic, Christian, Yazidi things that mattered more to the population of that area. And I started to think, along with a number of other people, that the Islamic State was targeting these ancient remains precisely so they would get into the Western news cycle. Because if you remember, you know, they had been doing these horrific executions by burning or other, you know, sort of mass shootings. And the Western media had played that, but then thought, you know, we don't need to spread these messages. So the reporting had cut down on those more graphic images. And then they came up with this alternate strategy. If we blow up a Roman temple, that's going to hit the news. And then they got more donations, more recruits from people who thought that was a sign of their power. So it's very complicated, the relationship between love and exploitation and hatred and ideology of all of these cultural remains, even of economics, right? When the site of Palmyra, Syria, this ancient Roman, very well preserved site was attacked by the Islamic State, that's going to have ongoing economic effects on that community because of the hit on tourism. So this is why I find all of this area of art crime fascinating. It's not just that, oh, I love this little bit of stone, nobody else can touch it, it's mine, mine, mine. It's how does the past shape our lives and our futures?
Yeah, it tremendously, it's all one. It repeats itself, I suppose, that it just seems so evil and terrible. And I think you're right. I just have this image of the gigantic statue of the Buddha being blown up. It is indeed tragic. And what They do. It really cuts to the heart of it. As you had said, the identity of an individual. And that's what makes artwork that lasts for centuries or thousands of years so absolutely perfect and incredible. And so in that, also with the destruction of artwork, there you talk about forgeries. And so ever since there's been artwork, there have been people forging art. And I don't know if that, how far back that goes, but you had said something about the Greeks who did that. How did that start? Like, because art became something that was of value to people other than intrinsic. It was a financial thing as well.
Yeah. And people have always loved the past and thought it neat to be holding something that one of their heroes made or even owned. Mm. And were willing to pay more for ancient art than contemporary art always. So Michelangelo actually got his start as a forger because he realized he could make 10, 20 times the amount of money making a statue that claimed to be ancient Roman or Greek than he could signing his name. So if you go to Florence, the Bargello Museum, there's a statue of Dionysus by Michelangelo with that's missing its hand because it never had one. He made it as an antique, buried it in the ground to age it for a while, and then a middleman sold it for him. So the very first statue that he made is a Pietà in a church in Rome that he made as himself, and it's the only statue he signed. It says the Virgin Mary is wearing a big sash across her chest, and it has Michelangelo in huge carved letters, like he is finally able to say, it's me, not the ancient Romans who made it.
Yeah, I've arrived. I've finally arrived. So would you say that he's potentially one of the greatest art forgerers in history, or are there some nowadays that are just beyond incredible, that names that are maybe hidden or that we don't know of?
Yeah, it depends what you mean by great. I mean, we know what Michelangelo made, so that's a little bit of a failing.
Yeah, that's right. The ones who succeed the most at fooling us, I suppose. So great, we'll use that with quotation marks.
But I also think that it's almost too easy to be an art forger because people want to own these works from the past or from particular artists or with particular histories. So if you're giving something to somebody who really wants it and is not motivated to ask questions to disprove what you're giving them because they want it so much, you know, you don't actually have to be that great. It's very rare that a forger gets subjected to a whole bunch of tests by somebody who wants to uncover it because, you know, the dealer doesn't make money if they sell a fake. The buyer doesn't get to show off their new masterpiece if they know it's a fake. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I know I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but I just watched a documentary on the theft at the Isabella Stuart Gardner Museum. Did you have any interest, or were you studying in that or following what the latest might be on the theft of those pieces of art?
Oh, you don't want to ask me about it. I'm too depressing about that case.
It's a rabbit hole.
No. So it remains the largest value property theft in the U.S. A number of people broke in, took a security guard hostage, and took a number of paintings, including Rembrandt, Vermeer, and then seemed to have disappeared off the face of the earth. There have been some potential sightings and photographs that may or may not be, but those have really slowed down. And if you look at what happens in similar museum heists, where people take objects off of display, off of the walls, you see generally one of two outcomes. Let's say three. Mm-hmm. All right. If you know what you're doing, you'll steal from a museum with an insurance policy, and then you can return that for no questions asked reward, which is some percentage of the insurance valuation. So this often happens in Europe. But in US museums generally don't have that type of insurance policy precisely because they think it incentivizes theft of this sort. Or you took it because you don't know what you're doing. You are usually someone who is good at stealing things. And you see that a museum has terrible security, which many of them do. Yeah. And you know, in theory, that these objects on the wall are worth a lot of money. So you think, I'm just going to take them and then figure out what to do with them later. You wake up the next morning and there are, you know, headlines across the country saying this particular painting was just stolen. And you think, oh, no. What, you know, I'm never going to be able to sell it. Sometimes people do still do try it and sell things, and then they get immediately caught. Sometimes they give up and, you know, phone it into the police and say, come get this painting from this bus stop or this church or something, mm-hmm. because they know that once the art is recovered, the heat will be off to find them. Mm-hmm. And often and distressingly, people will destroy what they've stolen to try and destroy the evidence. They'll burn it, they'll throw it into rivers, they'll bury it. So what I think most probably happened in the Isabella Stewart Gardner case is that somebody decided to lay low and they have, you know, put these paintings in an attic or buried in a backyard or something. And you just can't leave these old and fragile paintings in non-professional storage for that many years without them disintegrating. If that is, they didn't just destroy them immediately. So I hold out very little hope that these objects will ever come back, which again, makes me pretty depressing. Like, people want to think that these will reappear and we'll suddenly have them again. But I'm a pessimist.
Not looking good. I want to ask you, I think this would be kind of a great, kind of bring it to modern times. You are, I don't know how close you are, if it's already been, the book has been written and you're waiting for a publication, but it's called Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of America's Public Monuments. And that is something we are, anybody who ever watches the news is very familiar with. We've seen a lot of the Confederate statues being torn down at protests, you know, given the Black Lives Movement and the, you know, the killings by the police, you know, of Black men. This is really has erupted over the last few years, and especially in the last year. So tell me about that, and what's the gravitas of it? Like, is this and ever going to be settled, or is this going to be an ongoing debate? And about your book as well, what direction is it taking with that?
Yes, yeah, so the book is in copy editing now. Should be published this winter by Norton. And I wanted to find out exactly those questions. What has been happening? Because there's been a lot of news stories, but I found, you know, the sort of lack of follow-up. As one big example of that, you just said Confederate statues are being torn down at protests, but I spent a couple of weeks tracking down the aftermath, the fate of statues that have been taken off their pedestals in the aftermath of the 2020 George Floyd protests. And I found that actually only a relatively small percentage were taken down by protesters. Most were taken by authorities, some because they were in sympathy with the protesters' thoughts about the statues, others because they wanted to preserve public order or even protect the statues. And that even the statues that were toppled by protesters have, along with the officially removed ones, all gone into storage. Or been relocated to say cemeteries or given back to private organizations that are pro-Confederacy, et cetera. So to me, it's so interesting that the terms of the debate are like, should we keep these statues exactly where they are, or should we tear them to pieces and never see them again? But really what's been happening is, should we keep the statues in one place or should we move them a couple of blocks away to another place, which seems to change it. So I wanted to, you asked if this debate is ever going to settle down. And I think no, because the purpose of public statuary is to define to ourselves who we want to be as a nation, whose acts should be honored, whose past should be remembered and emulated. So it's not a debate about the past, it's a debate about the future. And again, anybody who reads the news knows that there are a lot of divisions in America as to how to answer these questions. So I think it's very exciting to think about people not just remaining content with these statues, but having their voices heard, which is another big discovery I made when writing this book, is that I saw a lot of people reacting and saying, well, okay, we should have debates about statues, but we shouldn't do it in this violent protest way. That's, you know, hijacking the democratic process. If a community doesn't want a statue, it should vote and take the statue down democratically. But what I didn't realize when I started, and what I think is a lot of people still don't realize, is that A, these statues were never democratically put up in the first place. It's not like there was a community-wide vote. It was a small group of wealthy individuals deciding that they wanted to honor this particular person. And often these statues were controversial in the community from when they very first went up. And B, in many states, there are explicit laws prohibiting the removal or even changing the signage on any public monuments. So there simply is no democratic process. So if anything, I want to come out of the book is this idea of, great, let's talk about these things. Let's vote on these things, but we need to have a mechanism to do that. Because to me, it looks very different if you consider the case of a protester tearing down a statue and you think that was just a whim, that they're angry and they saw a statue as a community target, versus if you know that that very same protester has for decades been trying to file paperwork to have a reconsideration of that statue, only for those petitions to be thrown away because there never was any protest or process to take a statue down. So that, for example, was the case with the activists I interviewed for one of my chapters who toppled a statue of Columbus at the Minnesota State Capitol. Because he had been trying for so many years with absolutely no result.
You know, that harkens to what you were talking about earlier, how ISIS would go into a town and take down something that symbolized the cultural identity of a group or a town or a religion. And so it's almost the same thing, but the opposite in a way. So as opposed to terrorizing a group, this is theoretically bringing in both sides of the coin. This is about a world that is fair and just and doesn't honor a tradition of slavery or what the Confederacy fought for. But when these statues are taken down, even if there's a due legal process, don't you think that in a way that it makes the people who believe in that or as their cultural identity dig their heels in even more? I'm not saying they shouldn't be taken down, because I agree with that movement, but it almost really ratchets them up almost to a, like, to the next level. And that's where the violence and the fighting begins. So this is big. This is about the identity of our nation.
And that's another thing that a big concern I had when writing the book, and something I tried to do in the book. And what I tried to do is think about the meaning of these statues for people who consider themselves to be descendants of those honored, whether explorers or Confederate heroes, et cetera. And what I tried to do was dig into the history of these statues to think about what exactly were they meant to convey to these audiences. And what I found was that people assume they're being honored by the statues, but the statues often were praising some quality of obedience or submission to authority, precisely the type of elite authorities who put up the statues. So a lot of Confederate monuments that honor the Confederate private, the sort of low-ranking Confederate soldier, the anonymous soldier, went up during periods of labor agitation when working class Southerners, both Black and white, were banding together to try to unionize, to try and get fair wages. And as part of union breaking campaigns, the owners and managers of these factories, these mines, et cetera, often put up Confederate monuments of a low ranking soldier and then had these big celebrations with speeches that praise the obedience of this soldier to authorities, the generals, General Lee, Stonewall Jackson, et cetera, and emphasize the pure whiteness of the soldier and how these soldiers defended their families against the hideous specter of threatened racial equality, et cetera, as a way of saying, don't agitate against your bosses, people, and don't make cross-racial alliances because that would be betraying your heritage. So I do not think that many of these statues that people are defending have the meaning to them that is the intended meaning. So I don't hold out hope that I can convince everybody to change their minds, but maybe some people will see that these statues aren't really a pat on the back to people. They're shoving them back into a certain type of line.
Into I wouldn't necessarily say servitude, but at least that's what in this instance it kind of represents, trying to keep the status quo for the people who hold the land, the factories, the money. You stay there, and you know, and then the rich owners are high-fiving behind the statue while there's like a celebration going on in the background. That's incredible. I hadn't thought about that, but it makes so much sense. There's a, you know, art represents something, and that's the beauty of it. Like, what is art, right? So it statue and in just basic intrinsic value, a statue of Robert E. Lee is they can be very beautiful, incredible. This general on a horse, proudly, you know, looking, surveying a landscape, and I get it, I get that, but it's almost like there should be like a museum for it all or something. I mean, we still it very different. Very different. So I'm not trying to make the thing, but like, you know, I've been to Dachau, the concentration camp, and it was really powerful that it existed, even though the barracks had all been taken down. There was a kind of a fake one that worked for me. Like, I mean, not that I didn't have that sensitivity to it, but being there, whew, like a life experience. And I'm not saying that walking by a statue is going to do that, but destroying it, it doesn't really do jack. Taking it out of the town square, different story right there. But
yeah, I think whatever you do, whether you destroy it, you put it in a museum, you move it to a cemetery, if you do that without having the conversation, without having the acknowledgement of what this history has been about, then that's worse than doing nothing. That just reinforces the message that the statue has been sending.
Mm.
Yeah, wow, that's fascinating. Before I let you go, I want to ask you briefly, because it seems really like an incredible subject. You did a lot of work in studying the Guantanamo Bay military detention camp and the artwork created there. Could you just kind of give me a little summary of that? Because it to me, that's another ongoing thing, although kind of hidden from our sight. Like, you know, nobody knows anything about Guantanamo Bay other than, you know, the Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson story. Seriously, like, it's like, but what did you find there? Because it's fascinating.
Well, I think It's actually an interesting link between monuments and Guantanamo Bay because they both have the privilege of being boring. We think we know the story and we think it'll be boring to investigate anymore. So it's hard to get people to pay attention. And I certainly was one of those people until I got a phone call from a lawyer who said, my cousin's an artist who knows you, and I was wondering if you might be interested in curating a display of some of my client's art. They're making art at Guantanamo. And I thought, what do you mean they're making art at Guantanamo? That makes no sense. So it was, I knew even before I saw the art that I had to do this exhibit because of that reaction, which is a reaction then that many people had. This surprise that pries open your interest, and then you can get into a topic and maybe think some more about that topic in a way you hadn't before. So many people came to this exhibit that I put on in 2017 with a couple of co-curators at my college, at John Jay College, and said, "Oh, I thought Guantanamo had closed." And no, definitely not. It's still there. There's still 40 men there. 10 of them have been cleared for release, but are still there because of various bureaucracies. And some have been for years cleared for release. So many of them have never even been charged with a crime. It's really ridiculous. And so this art I put, I think there's 36 pieces, just a little small show. There'd been an official art making program at Guantanamo since 2009. And then they had been cleared for release, these artworks. So they're all stamped, approved by US forces. They're all scrutinized, make sure no hidden messages and these paintings of flowers and landscapes and et cetera. And detainees had sent them to their lawyers, and then the lawyers lent them to me. And I thought nobody was really going to care. There's a number of art galleries at my college, and I chose the one that was essentially in a glorified hallway in the administrative offices because I thought at least members of the community will be forced to walk through it. But it turns out that people cared in part because the Pentagon kind of freaked out, and there was just one news story about the opening of the exhibit, and then the Pentagon said, "We're changing our policy. No more art can leave Guantanamo. Detainees can only keep a limited amount of the art they make, and they'll have to discard the rest." There was talk about maybe burning the art. There's talk about the art that had left Guantanamo still being property of the government. It was just a whole big thing. And that got so many people talking about the art and about Guantanamo. And people on many sides, with many beliefs about who these men were. So whether you thought they had anything to do with acts of terrorism or not, whether you thought this was drawing attention to their unjust or drawing attention to their unjust detention, or whether you thought this was drawing attention to the fact that there hadn't been a concluded trials yet. So, your family members who had died in the Twin Towers hadn't gotten justice yet, and you wanted trials to happen to ascertain whether these men were guilty or not. I got thanks and condemnation from a lot of places. And it is ongoing. So part of the aftermath of this show is a lot of more lawyers came to me and said, "I also have file cabinets full of this stuff." So now I know where I think more than 1,000 pieces of art made at Guantanamo are. And there's going to be a new show opening at Old Dominion University in Virginia in January, a much expanded version. And hopefully that will travel around. And there have been other things too, like one former detainee, Mansour Adafi, who wrote a piece for the exhibit catalog, kept writing and had a couple of pieces in the New York Times, a Modern Love column, and now his memoir called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo is coming out from Hachette in August. You can pre-order. I recommend. He's a wonderful writer. But again, like we were talking about at the beginning, getting interested in some subject matter and just finding out more and finding out more and talking to people and making connections and then realizing, oh, okay, I guess I'm one of the experts on this now, which I always feel like I shouldn't be, not because I think I'm don't know anything, but like so many more people should be interested in these things.
Exactly. So just kind of on that Guantanamo thing, would you describe the art? Is there a mood to it? Is it dark? Is it light? Is it hopeful? What does it say about the human condition of people who have been imprisoned for, you know, a decade beyond and 20 years, I think, now?
Well, I called the original show Ode to the Sea because I noticed that one of the themes of the art was water. There are so many paintings of the ocean and boats under sail and the seashore and lakes and rivers and et cetera. And I finally was talking to Mansoor over Skype. He's now in Serbia. And I asked, you know, what's with all the water? Were you, you know, modeling it after what you could see? And he's like, what are you talking about? We couldn't see the ocean. They were yards away from the ocean, but there were tarps over all the fences to hide them from view. But also just as sort of the cruelty of keeping what they could see so industrial, so ugly. And so a lot of the art is this type of attempt to bring beauty and landscape and nature back into their lives. So they would make them essentially as windows for their cells to have something beautiful to look at. So there are, most of them are very soft and gentle. There are a few pieces, a few artists expressed some spikier things. In the new show, there's a drawing of the Statue of Liberty chained up like a detainee, and another of her drowning under a rising flood. There's also sort of prohibitions on wanting to express that type of anger. So it's so fascinating. You know, it's partly a venue for expression, but partly everything they were doing was so scrutinized that they didn't want to always reveal so clearly what they were thinking. So sometimes they would tell their lawyers afterwards, you know, this is the interpretation. So one artist, Bada Rabani, painted this beautiful little still life study of empty glasses and an empty pitcher. And then once he sent it to his lawyer and she got it, he said, okay, the real meaning of this is a portrait of my family. But he didn't want to give anyone of the authorities at Guantanamo sort of the pleasure of seeing him missing his family. So he could only express it in this removed way.
Wow. Is there a place online that we can see this?
Yeah. Artfromguantanamo.com, all one word, is a website I set up, which doesn't have all of it, but pretty fair amounts. And then some biographies of the men too.
The common thread that human beings share, right? You know, I mean, even though they're the reasons, at least, that they are there imprisoned brings up a tragic and awful memory, and viscerally speaking, for, you know, the families of thousands of people who died on 9/11, that we're all kind of the same, you know, like that's what art is. It's just an expression of a feeling and that the individual wants to convey and share to the world. And that's what the beauty.
Yeah. And that's what the makers told me, because I asked them all, usually through lawyers, so an endless process of sort of questions and sending and interviews at Guantanamo as part of legal conferences and then clearing notes for security release and then back to me. But they all said, yes, we want our art to be displayed because we want Americans to see that we're human beings, you know, regardless of what else they think of us. We've been portrayed as monsters, as animals, as subhuman, but you know what? No, we're human beings.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. I'm really excited to see that. And I'm excited to read your book as well, that is in the copy phase now. So do you have an editor who is just ruthless, like Aaron, I told you not to use this word more than once per book, or so. I mean, or is it brutal, or are you feeling good about the process right now?
I'm feeling good. My editor is very flattering. He does the praise sandwich very well. This is wonderful. This is terrible, Change Holders. And this is wonderful too. So I'm like, oh, okay.
That's right. The best editors are probably, they love what they love, but when there's something they don't like, they let you know. You want an honest editor. You don't want somebody just, saying, oh, you're amazing. This is beautiful. Then your book's going to not be very good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I will be sure to share that when that time comes, and the Guantanamo. And are there any links where if people are interested in learning about you and your work that you would suggest, like would it be your website, Twitter, maybe our favorite little place to chit chat about punk rock music?
I'm on Twitter way too much at Art Crime Prof. And that's also my website, artcrimeprof.com.
Fantastic. It's a great website. And that was, as I had said before, I believe we officially started talking, it was a rabbit hole for me. And I was like, suddenly I thought I knew what I wanted to ask you about. And I'm like, I don't even know what I want to talk to her about. There are so many ways to go. My gut is I hope that we can talk again, perhaps maybe when the book comes out. That might be a great time to just and see how things shake, because the next things are unfolding now, and it's wonderful. And your time is valuable. I know you'd said that you brought your children to the beach the other day. I don't know how your weather is, but hopefully you get a great vacation this summer and inspire your students next semester.
Vacation? What's that?
You're well, always
it was lovely to talk to you.
Aaron Thompson can be found at artcrimeprof.com. Her Twitter handle is at artcrimeprof. Check both of them out. You won't regret it. Thank you to Aaron Thompson for being a guest on The Happiness Quotient. Her upcoming book is Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of America's Public Monuments. That will be by W.W. Norton. And, oh, by the way, their Twitter handle is at W.W. Norton. How it feels now and then. I got a happiness just, my friend. Thank you to the Wood Brothers and their management for the use of their song Happiness Jones for our theme song here on The Happiness Quotient, and to their publicist, Kevin Calabro, for helping make it happen. If you'd like a free downloadable PDF of The Happiness Quotient's A Course in Happiness, visit me at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient. And for more information about me, to inquire about personal coaching or public speaking in person or virtually, visit me at eyesopenproductions.com. You can write me anytime at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail. And come to think of it, my Twitter is at tom_Pollard. Check it out. I'm not nearly as entertaining as our guest, Aaron Thompson, but it might be worth checking out if you're into some of the stuff that I'm into. Thank you for visiting The Happiness Quotient. I will see you all real soon. Happy, 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 happiness.